The Washington Post in 2008 ran a really interesting story. What they did is they got the one of the world's best classical musicians. His name is Joshua Bell. The Washington Post got him to play at the exit of a Washington subway to play some of the world's best, I guess it depends how you define best in terms of classical, but some of the world's most famous classical pieces. He played for 43 minutes. Just 2 days before that, he had played at a sold-out event where tickets cost approximately $100 a head, and it had been completely sold out. They talked to a famous conductor, and they said, you know, what do you think will happen when we do this experiment? Because they expect, he said, well, look, you'll get a crowd gathering. You'll get people hearing this classical musician, and a crowd will gather. So the Washington Post reporters had put in place all these contingencies about if a big crowd gathered and text messages went out and, you know, Twitter was used to have a free concert in a Washington subway. So they'd organised some police maybe even for crowd control in case that went ahead. Over the 43 minutes, 1,097 people walked past. 27 people stopped. Most for less than a minute. One man stopped for 8 or 9 minutes. And Joshua Bell received $32 in payment for busking, when normally he charges out at thousands of dollars an hour. People just didn't recognise the wonder of what was happening. The amazing quality of the music, the amazing instrument, and some of the most elegant pieces in the world. Now, occasionally you hear about this with artworks, don't you? That some artwork is discovered, some lost artwork, and it's been painted by a famous painter, and it's been sitting in an innocuous place down the back of some old art gallery somewhere, and thousands of people have looked at it, but no one's recognised it. But if you took that same painting and you put the right kind of frame on it and you put it in the right kind of building next to the other kind of paintings of the same calibre, suddenly it would be worthy of notice. Well, I think Jesus' words are a little bit like that. In our society, they're very known. They're very accessible. They're very available. In fact, they're so known, accessible, and available that they are no longer known, accessible, and available. Maybe the classic example is you're travelling for work. You sit down in a hotel conference room, you know, hotel room, and you open up the bedside cupboard, and what do you find in there? A Gideon's. You know, a Gideon's. You close it. I wonder what's on Desperate Housewives tonight. And, you know, we missed the opportunity. I'm hoping that in this series, on the heart of the matter, looking at Jesus' words, that I'll actually help you, help us, hear Jesus' words freshly. Hear them with challenge. Hear them with depth. Hear them with some radicalness. So I'm really glad you're here, and I hope that's my aim over this series of six talks over the coming 6 months. Now, it doesn't matter whether you're Christian or not, or whether you've read the Bible or not. Hopefully, this will help make Jesus' words accessible. Now, I didn't need to make a comment. You might not believe in God. You might not believe in some of the things that Christians believe. But I'm actually going to be trying to explain Jesus' words. And he presumes that God exists. So I'll, in a sense, just be presuming what he presumes in the way I speak. Now, that doesn't mean I'm assuming that you believe that. There's a question and answer time at the end, and we can open up questions about what I've said and challenge, you know, the existence of God and all sorts of things from this point forward. But I think the question for us really is, can we hear the words of Jesus? Will we hear the words of Jesus? And then will we respond to them? Well, since it's on about the words of Jesus, without further ado, let me read to you some of the words of Jesus from inside of your outline. Now, when Jesus saw the crowds, this is the start of the Sermon on the Mount. So just some context, Jesus has appeared. The famous story of Jesus' birth that we celebrate at Christmas has been told. Jesus started to gather his disciples to him. He's been tempted by Satan. And a large crowd is basically starting to gather around him. Matthew chapter 5, verse 1, or sentence 1. Then when Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. his disciples came to him, and he began to teach them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way, they persecuted the prophets who were before me." So we're going to explore some of those words now. So what is the blessed life? Jesus says, blessed are the blessed life might be the good life, the happy life, the fortunate life without connotations of luck. It might be the NRMA's unworry life, but actually even kind of more positive than that, the no worries life of Australia. Now, it does get a little bit interesting if you translate it happy. You can see there in the fourth sentence, blessed are the happy. Happy are those who mourn. Well, that doesn't really work, does it? So it's happiness, but it's greater. It's contentment, fulfillment, a deep peace. Well, let's work through some of these quickly. Blessed are the poor in spirit, Jesus says, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Jesus is saying, if spiritual assets were dollars, the happy people are those who recognize their poverty, their debt to God. The poor in spirit are those who depend on God, those who've got nothing to offer to God. Now, it's not saying that they're worthless, but that they themselves know they've got nothing to commend themselves to God. They're poor in spirit. How do you rate yourself spiritually? You know, do you rate yourself, you know, from 1 to 10? You know, 1, I'm a little bit spiritual. 10, I'm very spiritual. Well, Jesus is saying the most blessed people are those that recognize their spirituality is a 0. Moving on to the next one. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Jesus is saying the best life is one washed in tears because of moral failure. The background of the mourning, when you look through the Old Testament, is the mourning because of the state of the nation of Israel and the state of the people who followed God. They mourned for the wrongs that they'd done. They mourned for the state of their nation. So the best life, Jesus is saying, is one where it's washed in tears of moral failure. Thinking about it this way, our personal wrongs aren't just acknowledged that we, you know, done them, but that we're saddened by them, that we're grieved by them, that they matter to us. I'm going to ask a question. When was the last time you lamented? When was the last time we lamented a personal wrong? Not just because it was found out. You know, we often grieve about our personal wrongs or faults when they're found out and someone brings them to us and it's caused a problem. And afterwards we think, oh, but what about when they haven't even been discovered? But on view here is not just individual things, but maybe corporate things. When was it that you've heard of maybe government corruption, systemic abuse, the plunder of nations, and grieved over it, mourned over it? Or do we hear those things happen and just think, I'm glad it hasn't happened to me, rather than mourn over them? Well, blessed are the meek, Jesus says, for they will inherit the earth. A heavy metal band, I couldn't find its name, but it says something like, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit nothing, and I'll get everything. And that, you know, that's how we think of the meek. But the biblical view of the meek is a bit different. Are the meek people who are knocked over by the slap of a wet noodle? Are the meek indecisive and wishy-washy? No. Are the meek easygoing? Not in the Bible sense. I mean, you know, dogs are easygoing. No. In the Bible, meekness is not weakness. In the Bible, meekness is actually the ultimate team player. It's the person who puts somebody else, their needs, their opportunities before their own. The meek person is the person who doesn't have to justify themselves. You know, if something's happening, they don't have to kind of find their sense of worth from asserting themselves. The meek person actually considers other people's interests on par or above their own. Now, that's actually strength, isn't it? When you can be so confident in your sense of self-worth that you can be the ultimate team player and think, how, you know, in this thing that's happening, how could I benefit others? Or there's some conflict about, you know, there's some problem, who didn't do what, because you know, something's gone pear-shaped, and you don't justify yourself. Now, you might speak the truth, but you don't try and justify yourself because your strength is not found in that. Moving on. Jesus says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Do you hunger and thirst for that first strong coffee of the day? You know, you can't quite focus. You're kind of distracted until you've had that first strong coffee of the day. Well, you know, that's hunger and thirst. It keeps coming. You're trying to do some work, but it keeps coming back to your mind. Gee, I really need a coffee. I wouldn't mind a coffee. Gee, I wonder if, you know, the guy, the barista down there that I know is down at the coffee shop. It's kind of hungering and thirsting for it. Well, Jesus is saying people who are burning for God's will to be done in the world, who hunger and thirst for it, they have the good life. People who can't kind of focus unless they're confident or sure that God's will is happening in the world, God's perfect and holy goodwill is unfolding in their lives or the lives of the world. They hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed are the merciful. How should we think about that? I think maybe thinking about the unmerciful is a helpful way to kind of see that in the office environment. How do you see unmerciful people? I think you won't see unmerciful people when there's that person who's able to see everyone else's faults but actually unable to see their own faults. They have a hard view towards others and they can see all their problems, all their faults, all their inconsistencies. Whereas the merciful person in the office sees the faults. It's not that they're blind to the problems or faults or that things haven't gone well or things haven't been done properly. But the merciful person sees them, acknowledges their own contribution or their own faults, even in other areas, and then acts to try and fix them. Acts to try and work with the people to get it sorted out. Trying to think, how could we do better at this? How can I help this person to, you know, in this situation? A question. What Jesus would ask of us, I think, what is your attitude to the, around you, those who struggle emotionally or relationally or financially? Is it merciful or is it hard-hearted? It's kind of American republicanism. They ended up in that spot, they've got to lift themselves up by their own bootstraps. Jesus says, blessed are the pure in heart. In sentence 8, for they will seek God. Now, what is this? Well, this is an outward conformity to rules. The heart is the center of the personality. She's saying the best life is one of purity of heart. How do you test purity of heart? Well, what do you think about when your mind slips into neutral? How much sympathy do we have for deception? How much sympathy do we have for shady humor, even if it's really funny? What do we pay consistent allegiance to? What do we love? What and whom do we spend our effort and energy on? To what extent do our actions and our words show what is in our heart? And to what extent do our actions and words hide what is in our heart? Because we don't want other people to know. We're almost there in a list of Beatitudes. I wanted to move through them quite quickly, but I thought they're so important. They bring such a challenge to us that we should just spend a little bit of time on them. Sentence 9, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called sons of God. I think the ultimate peacemaker is really people who speak about Jesus, who brings peace between man and God. See that in the second half. For they will be called sons of God, the one who brings peace between God and human beings. But I think the peacemaker is the person who, in the situations of tension and frustration and anger, keeps a cool head, who doesn't let their emotions get in the way, lets actually the faults and what's gone wrong be clear and not caught up in our emotions and get complicated and let the pressure build and the heated words fly. The peacemaker quells that. And then finally, Jesus says, blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. I thought a whistleblower is the best definition of someone who's persecuted for righteousness. I saw a documentary a couple of years ago, and I've actually told this story before because it kind of surprised me so much. There was a man who worked for an airline engineering firm in the US, and they discovered that there was an ongoing fault with their planes that they actually suspected had led to a plane crashing. And he had tried to report it to the management above him, and they'd taken no notice. He tried to report it to all the internal safety reports, but they'd ignored it because of the cost of repairing it. So finally, he rang up the Aviation Authority in America to report it. And talks about the interview. He said, I rang them up and I said, look, I work for such and such a company, and I found this problem with one of our aircraft. And the man said to him, stop. Before you say anything else, you need to know that if you tell me this information, we will act on it, and you'll need to provide evidence, but we will act on it, and you will never work in the aviation industry in America ever again. You will be blacklisted by every aviation company because you have reported a fault in one company. Are you sure you want to go ahead? And the man did, and so it turned out to be true. He had to actually move overseas and get a job, and he couldn't even get a job in the aviation industry after that because companies are international. See, there was a man who was prepared to be, see that in sentence 10? Persecuted because of righteousness. He's prepared to do the right thing, even at great personal cost. Now, you might be sitting there thinking, well, hang on, Glenn. Are you telling me that the best life, summing all those things up, the best life is a life to be totally aware of sin, grieved by my personal failings, shocked by the things that are going on in the world and not ignoring them but lamenting them, full of mercy for all the people around me and filled with compassion for them, letting that hang on my life and my soul, constantly doing the right thing, even if it alienates my work colleagues and my friends around me? Glenn, you're telling me that that's the best life? Doesn't sound like a really good life to me. Yeah, it's a bit shocking and surprising. It's actually because Jesus has his words hinge on a different view of reality. This man is Johann Kepler. He was actually the start of modern science in the 17th century, in 1609, in the Western world. What did Johann Kepler do? Well, he changed the way people viewed reality. See, people had actually listened to Aristotle. Now, Aristotle, when it came to stars and moons and skies, Aristotle had basically held, philosophically, not from scientific experiment, had basically held that perfection was the circle, and that everything above Earth, up in space, was related to circles. So planets moved in a perfect circle. Now, Galileo came along with the telescope, actually just before Johann Kepler, and even was able to see the moon and see that it wasn't perfect, could see, you know, problems on the lunar landscape. But still, Galileo, couldn't shake Aristotle's philosophy. But Johann Kepler came along, and from using the telescope, not from his work, but from the work of his previous boss at his institution, saw that mathematically, that the planet Mars moved not in a perfect circle, but in a perfect ellipse. And so he put forward the proposal that actual planetary bodies rotate around the sun in a perfect ellipse. And then he did something incredible. He published this in a document, and he said, the reason I put this forward is actually because of my observations. I've looked at a bunch of observations, and I've noticed them, and I've seen that the observations point not to a circle, but to an ellipse. And that did two things. It overturned Aristotle's philosophy, which had dominated science for about 1,000 years, and opened the way up for the scientific method, which is, I have a hypothesis, and then I test it via observation. You know, I test it. My observation is that rain falls out of the sky. Well, I stick my hand out, and it does. And then I can back up my hypothesis or deny it. And so Johann Kepler opened the way for optics, how cameras worked, how glasses work, Einstein's theory of gravitational pull of planets, the basis of lots of physics in our world. Why? Because he had a different view of reality. He tried to assess it on what he saw, not on Aristotle's philosophy. Now, interestingly, Kepler said, someone asked him about this, and he said, well, actually, I believe in the background to the world there's a rational God. And so I looked for rational means. So he had all this mathematical data and tried to rationally make sense of it. But that's another point. See, Jesus had a different view of reality. Actually, we won't quite move there yet. We'll move to that next one. See, Jesus actually had a view that God was going to do something unique and incredible in the world through him. That God was going to start this thing called the kingdom of heaven. Now, the Jewish people, and Jesus was a Jew, did actually believe in a kingdom. And this yellow line is plotting. It's a little bit technical, but it's actually really helpful if you ever read the Old Testament. The yellow line plots the rise and fall of the political kingdom of the Jews. From Abraham they started, and they rose and rose and rose, as in terms of size and dominance and power and glory, until they were basically under King David. And then they fell. They got corrupted. The Assyrians came in and conquered them. The Babylonians came in and conquered them and took them off into exile. They came back from exile, but they never really rose again. But then, in that same period, the kingdom of God, or the kingdom of heaven, was promised. And you actually see it in the Old Testament. Oops. Here are some books of the Old Testament, Genesis, Exodus, a whole bunch of books in the Old Testament, that plot that geopolitical kingdom of God. But at the same time, after the nation goes into exile here, a whole bunch of prophets in the Old Testament write, guys like Isaiah, Ezekiel, Amos. And they write about two things at the same time. They write to the Jews who live in a geopolitical kingdom that's off in Babylon or back in Palestine. But they also talk about this amazing kingdom that God will bring, where God will be this great king, where the temple will be the biggest temple in the world, where the Jewish nation will be great and all peoples from all over the world will flock to the Jewish nation, where the lamb will lie down with the lion, where no one will shed each other's blood. There will be no more wars. Where everyone will take their sword and beat it into a plow so that they can just farm the ground. All nations will worship God together. And there's this amazing picture that just kept getting bigger and bigger and better and better. And, you know, kind of used language and ideas that transcended ordinary life. You know, as if a lion and a lamb would lie down together. Well, they might for a nanosecond, just before the lion pounced. But this picture, this promised kingdom of God, was promised in the Old Testament, and yet the Old Testament never used that language, never put those two words together. This geopolitical language of kingdom and of heaven or God. But Jesus came along, and look what he does. He promises the kingdom of heaven. See it there in the first two Beatitudes? It's there in sentence 3 and in sentence 10. These are like the bookends to everything that Jesus said. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Jesus saw that God was promising this great kingdom to come, and he was saying the good life is found in it. And so that's where it's a really long-term investment. Did you notice that all the other ones are future? Blessed are the poor in spirit, for there is a kingdom. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted in the future. The meek, for they will inherit the earth. Those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Jesus expected God's great kingdom to come in a new way, in an incredible way, and that he was going to bring it. See, and he was going to bring it. And so then all these blessings would flow. Now let me show you that Jesus thought he was at the center of it. You can see it there in sentence... Whoops, I've lost my page. You can see it there in sentence 11. Jesus says, "Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you." Why? Because of me. He saw himself as the linchpin to bringing the kingdom of heaven. So it's interesting. See, he's talking to, you can see in sentence one, he's talking to his disciples. He's not saying, this is the blessed life and the good life if you just meet this amazing moral standard. But rather, if you're a follower of me, if you're a disciple of me, then you'll have the good life. And the good life will entail all these things. But it'll entail one thing that will sustain you. See in sentence 12, "Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven." See, Jesus, the only way for this to be the good life, I think, is if you can accept Jesus' view of reality, that there is a heaven, and that God, there is a God will bring his spiritual rule to bear in the world. There will be a time when this, the world as we know it, will change and be kind of transformed into that incredible time. And it's only if we accept that reality that these things could be the good life. I don't know how they could be the good life. Mourning, meekness, hungering and thirsting for righteousness, unless that future reality is something you accept. So Jesus is asking us to make a really long-term investment. You know what an investment is? You miss out on something now. It's about an opportunity cost. You know, I miss out on spending $10 on a glorious dinner of McDonald's in order to save it and put it away so that I can get some interest on it and afford a glorious dinner at McDonald's, but extra large. And that doesn't really work, does it? But you know how it works. It's you miss out now because of the future. Well, see, Jesus' expectation is that God's doing something great, bringing the kingdom of God, bringing the kingdom of heaven. And so he says, this is the good life. This is the blessed life. Because it follows him and it brings the kingdom of heaven.